ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, presents.
Susan Crawford is Associate Professor of Law at Cardozo Law School in New York City, where she teaches cyber law and communications law. Mrs. Crawford writes about communications policy, digital copyright issues, and internet governance. Susan Crawford was elected for the ICANN board by the nominating committee. Her current term started after the 2005 annual meeting.
All right, so without further ado, I'm going to pass along to an ICANN board member, Susan Crawford.
Hi.
Who's taken some time from her busy schedule to join us today. She's going to talk to us a little bit about why she became involved in ICANN, some of her background, and also a little bit about what is intellectual property and how does it relate to ICANN. It's a word that you'll hear often. You will see lawyers here and there within the ICANN universe, and they must have some sort of interest for being here, so we'll talk a little bit about that. So, Susan, thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, thank you all for having me. I'm really happy to be here. My name is Susan Crawford, and I'm a member of the ICANN Board of Directors. I'm right in the middle of my three-year term, so my term will be over in 18 months. I have been around ICANN for a number of years. I was supposed to be a musician. Both of my parents are composers and pianists, and my mother sings, and we had a little trio when I was a kid. The three of us did everything together. And they went to my teachers in college, and they had heard that I might want to go to law school. And they were furious. They actually went to talk to my professors to say, no, she can't. Too many lawyers in the world. No more lawyers. We don't want her to be a lawyer. She must be a musician. They didn't succeed. I'm a rebel who became a lawyer. And I ended up going to law school. And then I was deeply in debt because my parents are composers. Remember that part? So I had no money. And I had to go work for a great big law firm to pay off my debts in Washington, D.C. And it just happened that in that law firm, there were people working on domain name issues. And I started working on it, too. And this is a tiny area of legal practice. But I became a specialist in understanding the beginnings of ICANN, its reason for being, sort of legitimacy, where does it come from? And I did a lot of writing and talking, because studying ICANN for someone like me is like being a biologist with a little petri dish, you know, in front of you. It's like an experiment. And it just started. This is new, and we don't know what's going to happen. So I have been studying ICANN and thinking about it in this way for several years. Well, since it started. Now, I still am a musician. I have the viola with me. I practice all the time, and I give concerts, and so that gives me a great deal of joy. But I slipped and became a lawyer. And in the middle of my life, I went through an adjustment. I became an academic. I now teach law. And so my business is to churn out more American lawyers. In the United States, we graduate 40,000 lawyers a year. 40,000 lawyers. And part of my job is to assist that. All right, so what I do at ICANN is, what's that? I don't produce it. Well, maybe I inspire, who knows?
Maybe you should teach music as well.
I'm going to music camp later this summer. They have music camp for adults. Yeah.
There you go.
One issue I really care about, actually, a serious note, is music and kids, because I think it's a great way to grow up, to play. Are you a musician? No?
Not really.
Not really. Okay. Because it's cooperative and yet really fun. You get to shine and yet do stuff with your buddies. It's really great. So I really believe in that. So at ICANN, now I've been on the board for, as I said, about a year and a half. And I serve on several board committees. In fact, one of the committees I chair is the meetings committee. And I'm very interested in your comments about this meeting, especially those of you who've never been to one of these things. Putting aside your complete confusion over what's going on, which I share for a long time, it's important to us to hear whether the format the way we run these meetings is making them as efficient and effective as possible. So I'm very interested in that. Translation is a key issue for us, and we keep adding money to the budget, trying to come up with ways to do that that are in a fair way for everybody. For a long time, I can't have him. I thought one of the things I could help with today is tell you some stories. So the first story is ICANN's founding myth. ICANN's story, the thing it tells itself about itself. Because it's sort of a virgin birth, an immaculate conception, in a way, which I'll try to explain, that there was this one guy, John Postel, with a long white beard, who everybody trusted. You heard this story? Okay, good, you heard that part. So we begin with that part of the story. Everybody sort of genuflex, and that's how we start. And he was running this whole thing out of a little black notebook. He knew everybody who had IP addresses and domain names. But the notebook got pretty thick, and so the U.S. government, my government, became interested in this, and they had a cooperative agreement with John at USC. And then John, the next step is that a private company became involved, Network Solutions, you've heard of them. They started registering domain names for the U.S., under contract with the U.S. government. But they were charging a lot. They were charging a lot, and they had really monopoly control over this market, and the U.S. was quite nervous and started trying to think of ways to make this into a different kind of organization. And John had the misfortune at that moment to die. And so ICANN came from this one guy with a long white beard, suddenly sprang into being as a new private corporation under California law. How did that happen? What happened at that moment? How did we suddenly get ICANN? The U.S. government will say it didn't create ICANN. It just wrote a white paper saying, here are the attributes that ICANN should have. And then it sort of arose. It just emerged. And this thing came into being in 1998 and started signing contracts with people. It's a fascinating story. There probably is some corporate influence, government manipulation, who knows, at the beginning of that story, but it's shrouded in darkness. ICANN just emerges. It's an immaculate conception. So I wanted to tell you that founding myth. That doesn't help your understanding as much as I would hope. Let's see if I can make that clear. The origins of ICANN as a U.S. instrumentality mean that it was formed in controversy. The rest of the world wasn't quite aware of domain names, but wasn't sure who should be handling it, and the U.S. government didn't want itself to have a heavy hand on the operation of ICANN, so they gave rise to a private corporation, which is what ICANN is now. This means that, you know, fast forwarding now to 2007, there's a lot of concern by other governments in the world saying, who is this California not-for-profit? Why should a California company be coordinating this key public resource, domain names and IP addresses? So it came from mystery, and it still has some remnants of the controversy that gave it birth. Had John lived, had this kind man with a long white beard lived, the whole situation would have been a lot smoother because everybody trusted him. He's one of these original internet actors that was trusted to act fairly with everybody. That's ICANN's founding myth, that it just arose. Another story I wanted to tell you about is the entry of the lawyers into ICANN. The technical people were doing fine. They didn't need lawyers. They were making domain names work and IP addresses be assigned. And then somebody noticed that large company trademarks, like McDonald's, were being registered as second-level domain names. And there's a famous story in Wired magazine called Billions Registered by a guy named Quitner. And he actually went and registered McDonald's.com before McDonald's, the hamburger company, figured out what a domain name was. He called them up. He said, McDonald's, I have your domain name. And they said, what's a domain name? They just didn't know. So there were a lot of entrepreneurs who jumped in and started, like Mr. Quitner, registering domain names of famous companies, because they thought it would be fun, it might be useful someday. This is before the birth of the commercial internet. We usually tag that first moment when the internet becomes something that you and I can use in summer of 1995. went with the Netscape IPO when we first had a browser that could be used by everyone. So before that, a lot of registration at big company banks. And this practice could be called entrepreneurial or adventurous, but it got this label of cyber squad. And what these people were doing was holding up large companies to be paid to relinquish the name, so that you were hoping that McDonald's would pay you, you know, $20,000 to get its domain name back once they realized what its value was. So there was a moment when the trademark lawyers recognized that there was something big going on with domain names, and they really needed to get involved to ensure that those cyber-squatted domain names got returned to the companies that had trademarks that were being arguably infringed. Does this all make sense? Does the concept of cyber-squatting make sense to you all? Okay, and you know all about it. And this is all. Okay. So, ICANN was formed in part in 1998 in order to solve this problem. We needed a quick dispute resolution procedure which would allow unhappy corporations, mostly, to file a pleading or a piece of paper with an arbitrator saying someone is using my trademark in the form of a domain name and I want it back, and I want it back quickly. So we started something at the origin of ICANN called the Uniform Dispute Resolution Policy, the UDRP, which solved this cyber-squatting issue. And many people have argued that it gives too much power to the large trademark-owning corporations. It gives almost a presumption that they will get back their names too quickly for the entrepreneur that has registered the domain name. So that's one version of the story. The other version is, and these are trademarks, and the big companies really had a right to hang on to them. They should get them back. So the first web of contracts that gave rise to ICANN in 1998 had, as a big part of it, adoption of this Uniform Dispute Resolution Policy. And it's a fascinating thing. As a condition of registering a domain name in a generic top-level domain, like info, biz, and com, you agree as a registrant that your name can be taken away from you if you are found by an arbitral panel to be infringing on the trademark rights of someone else. That's all it is. That's what the policy says. I agree that using this contractual link, the registry can actually take the name from me and give it to someone else if that other actor succeeds in a proceeding against me. What's fascinating about this from the legal point of view is that the UDRP is not based on any particular law. It's not a law. It's just a policy that ICANN has adopted that is it's made effective. It's like it has a hammer attached to it because of ICANN's contractual control over the registry and the registrar, and then hence the registrant. So ICANN has a contract with the wholesale level registry like .com, who in turn has a contract with the customer-facing retail registrar, like Register.com in the United States, who in turn has a contract with Susan, the registrant. And so when I register a name, they can yank that chain all the way up. If I have failed, you know, if I'm infringing someone else's trademark, and get it back. And so energy and upset and excitement and money around the issue of trademarks had a lot to do with the formation of ICANN in the first place to solve this problem. Jake, does that help? Right. Okay. Any questions about this? This is my favorite topic.
Oh, I'm glad to hear this is one of your favorite topics. I heard a question in one of the public forums this week.
Yeah.
And I would like to hear what you have to say about it. They said, we don't, or what happens when the trademark post-dates the domain name? For instance, what if I owned Pepsi.com before Pepsi was founded? What if I owned Subway before Subway was founded? Or what if, like Subway, several people could claim, that's two different questions, but
right.
There are some that several people could lay claim to. And what if it does post-date the domain name? And how could the trademark have rights above and beyond those of someone who owned it first?
What was the answer to you?
It was not answered. That's why I'm asking you.
Okay. All right.
You have to show trademark rights as a complainant in one of these proceedings that come before the registering of a domain name. So if I happened to have the first name Pepsi, and I was born in 1840 or something, I'm the great-grandmother of somebody else, and I register this name Pepsi in honor of my grandmother, and that predates an imaginary company called Pepsi that didn't come into being until 2000. Pepsi, the big company, loses in that instance because what cyber squatting is defined as is the bad faith registration of a domain name. So it's the intent to get money from someone else, from a trademark owner, in exchange for a domain name. That is the definition of cyber squatting. So the policy, the Uniform Dispute Resolution Policy, has a bunch of factors that will weigh in my favor if I started using it before the big company's trademark was registered. So if it's my name, if I have a good faith reason to have it, all kinds of things. If I had a registration beforehand, all that stuff, that will operate in my favor, and I won't lose the name to a EBRP proceeding. So I see it. So I'm moving.
Okay.
Sorry,
I have same question.
Okay. Just since you said the bad faith.
Yeah.
I suppose I registered it without bad faith. Does that make a difference?
It should make a difference. One issue that's been raised is that the panelists rule very, very often in favor of the trademark holder. More than 80% of the time, the trademark holder wins. So even though you're supposed to find bad faith, they may not do enough fact-finding. And often the person complained of, the defendant, fails to respond, just defaults, because they don't have a lawyer or they can't, get there in time. And so a lot of those cases are lost that way. So there is some unfairness, perhaps, in the process. I saw a hand over here.
Well, I'm going to say that even if you register a domain name for example, my name is Pepsi, and I register it, and I can prove that my name is actually Pepsi, even if it dates after the trademark of the Pepsi the company Pepsi, I would still have some changes to win. It means that you just need to prove that you did it on one page. So there are some typical examples, like if you are called Pepsi,
right,
or if you have a company that is called Pepsi, but you are in the business of selling cars and not in beverages, things like that. So even in that case, you could still win, but you have to count with all the other barriers that you could have to win to realistically win a legal battle against a giant like Pepsi or
Right. Right. Now, I want to make very clear that this entire story about the EDRP applies to this part of ICANN's opportunity. So here are all the relationships with the generic top-level domains, which include sponsored ones like co-op and museum. That's where the UDRP operates. For the CCTLDs who pre-existed ICANN, John Postel just gave them out to his friends. They don't necessarily use this scheme at all. Maybe all of you already understand that, but ICANN does not have the same contractual relationship with the CCs that it does with the generics. World divides into two. Other questions? Well, Jacob seems to have control. Go ahead.
That's what I was going to ask about. If I am a CCTLD and I wanted to use the UDRP, is there any change to help me?
Oh, you could absolutely elect to use it as a registry. Find a provider, and then again, what you're doing is making sure that your chain of contracts, if you use resellers, in between you and the registrant, making sure that that chain obligates the registrant to lose control of the name automatically if the cyber squatting decision goes against them. Absolutely, you could adopt it. And their WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, acts as a arbitration provider on many of these cyber squatting cases, and they'll provide these services for free to you often.
Do I have to make any changes?
If you're a CC, you can do whatever you want. If you're a CC, you can adopt your own localized form of dispute resolution policy or LDRP, whatever you want to do that you feel will help your community with these kinds of disputes. In the generic world, we found that the disputes have really gone down in number over time because people have figured out that cyber squatting doesn't turn out to be a good business because you run this risk of losing your name. So, here?
Yes. I'm not really worried about the policy, but I received the WIPO daily newsletter, and I read it as I read the newspaper. And once you read it, you realize that something's wrong with the interpretation of some panelists.
Yeah.
I mean, the requirements are so basic and simple, they would be easier to understand than then they made the decision of the president or previous decisions, and kind of feel like there is no uniform criteria about the decisions, so you kind of get lost. So I know you can go to a court and do whatever you need, but if there's something to do about the panelists and the criteria.
Yeah, well, we're a little bit in the weeds, as an American would say. We're down in the details of how this all works out. But yes, there have been challenges to panelists who are found to be biased or really not paying attention to what the policy says and what the details are that they're supposed to follow. But that is a difficult area because WIPO, again, is doing this a lot of this for free. Now, Frank needs to talk, right? So we need to... Okay, another question. And then...
Sure. Yeah. As a matter of fact, the question is related to that one. Could you explain what's going on in the market? I mean, because it seems to me that the UPRP was created to avoid the court. But it seems to me that in America, for example, people are going to court instead of using the UPRP.
Well, I've got a great response to this. The U.S. Senate and our Congress, noticing that this UDRP thing was happening inside ICANN, decided to pass our own statute. We have something in the U.S. called the Anti-Cybersquatting Consumer Protection Act, which is very similar to the UDRP. So you can actually sue in the United States and get the same kind of judicial relief that you're seeking through the UDRP. What's different about the UDRP is that there's this automatic nature to it because it's part of the chain of contracts. The registrar will respond to a notice from the arbitral panel and will yank the name. Not necessarily so easy to enforce using the statute. But we love to litigate in the United States. That's what we do. And so that's the problem. I told them I'm helping coin lawyers. It's a terrible thing. And so there are often lawsuits over this as well as disputes.
This one was one easy way not to lose the clients.
Not to lose the clients.
Lose the clients. Because, you know, the wife who can do this for $1,000 or something like that.
Right.
Why are we going to lose those big clients for $1,000?
That's true. This is a conference that is also very good for networking. You know, making friends, talking, finding out about new products and services. On the board, I get to do less of that now than I did when I was sort of a private citizen. And so I urge you all to really connect with each other, exchange cards, do all of that, because that's a wonderful benefit of this program. And so now I want to make a plug for something I do, which is not ICANN, but I have started a sort of an Earth Day for the Internet called One Web Day on September 22nd each year. Around the world to celebrate the changes that the internet has made in human lives, to have celebrations in public places and online about just to step back for a moment and recognize how much good the internet does. I have decided to put the next 10 years of my life into making sure this holiday takes off every September 22nd. So look at our site. It's oneWebDay.org. We're nonprofit. There's no money involved in this at all. This is just trying to encourage people to celebrate the internet, and I urge you to get involved if you're at all interested.
ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, presented